sonata, the so-called Funeral March Sonata. Well, that's it for the Sunday morning. I'm so glad that you could join me, and I hope you'll be able to join me again next week when my featured pianists will be Arthur Schnabel and Dino Lipatti. And from 11, we'll be hearing music written for or about education and music teachers. That's 9 o'clock next Sunday morning here on BBC Radio 3. Sunday morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
Sergei Rachmaninoff and Nikolai Metner started out from very similar places as graduates of the Moscow Conservatoire. They both made careers in the West as brilliant pianist composers. But while Rachmaninoff, in the interest of a faster car or a new speedboat, would cut a deal or fall in with a promoter's request for something more popular, Metner never would. Rachmaninoff hugely admired the music of his fellow Russian and did an enormous amount to help him in his career. Yet Rachmaninoff ended his days in a mansion in Beverly Hills, while Metner died in a semi-detached in a North London suburb. Metner and Rachmaninoff, composer pianists of the week. Weekdays at 12 noon and 6:30.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's a minute past noon and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Sir Tim Smith is a businessman, but he's probably most famous for his wonderful work on the Lost Gardens of Heligan and the Eden Project, both, of course, in Cornwall in Britain. Let's talk a little bit about that first, Tim. How did that come about? Presumably your family were around there.
Well, I moved to Cornwall in 1987, having been in the music industry for a while, and I fell hopelessly out of love with the music industry and decided I was going to change my life and build a recording studio to do film music or something. And I was given a pig, and this pig and I became mates, and I decided that I wanted to actually set up a rare breed park, and I looked for some land, and I couldn't find the right land, but I met a guy who just inherited an estate that hadn't been touched for just about 70 years, and he invited me to cut into it with him, and I fell hopelessly in love with it. And not knowing anything about plants other than green side up, I decided I would restore the garden with my friend John Nelson, and we just did it. It became like a Fitzcarraldo job. We just did it. And then we opened it to the public, and it was successful. But it was an extraordinary time because it was a career choice that was sort of not even thought about. And it took over my life.
When you said the music business, what aspects of music were you involved with?
I was a composer to start with. And then because nobody wanted to record my compositions, I ended up with my friend Charlie Scarbeck recording them and then finding singers to sing on them. We spent years being, you know, artists in garrets, so to speak, and then we struck lucky in the early 80s with an opera singer called Louise Tucker. We made several albums with her, which kind of synthesizer music with opera, and it caught on all over Europe and in America and Canada. So we did very well for a while, but actually the music business as such, it was almost killing my love of music. There was something about the thrill of waking up in the morning and playing the piano and then recording something, and by nighttime something which didn't exist exists, is an excitement which still gives me goosebumps. But dealing with record companies and being a product is something that felt like a form of death to me. I've played the piano since I was 2, but I've never really had much of an interest in playing other people's music. It was always kind of a very personal journey, which began with banging all the notes and putting my foot on the sustain pedal and waiting. I loved listening to the echo of this and going on forever and ever. And then suddenly, well, you know this, suddenly, after maybe a minute and a half, there's this huge chord. It's like chaos becomes harmony right at the end. And that just thrilled me. And I used to do that for hour and hour after hour. And my granny used to be driven nuts. Me doing that.
Well, one of the reasons we asked you now, actually, funnily enough, was because, of course, we've got piano season on Radio 3, so you seemed an ideal guest from that point of view.
Thank you. I've very rarely been referred to as an ideal guest.
Well, you're going to introduce us to quite a bit of piano music, but certainly not exclusively so. And the first is Dave Brubeck. I think this was school days that this goes back to.
That's right. I was at a place called Cranbrook School in Kent, and there was a very gifted guy several years my senior called Guy Lintott, actually, who was a really good pianist, and he adored Brubeck. I'd never heard of Brubeck, but I just became an instant fan listening to this stuff, and it felt so sophisticated. And after he'd stopped playing, I would sneak into the piano room, and I would just, because I was doing it by ear, and having mastered the first few bars of Blue Rondo, I felt so grown up. I felt I was on a journey somewhere else, and I'd shake my head like an artist. And I can remember it as if it was yesterday, and it just felt so alive.
Blue Rondo à la Turque, the Dave Brubeck Quartet. So, did you take up playing the piano when you were young?
I took it up, but in a very cavalier way. I took it up, A, because the music mistress at my prep school was devastatingly beautiful, and B, because I thought that I'd like to play classical music, and discovered that I got a lazy eye, and as you know, really good musicians can read music in patterns and shape, and it becomes natural after a while. For me, the notes just kept drifting. They were drifting all over. Everything I played was like the blues. So eventually I had to come up with a technique of learning the piece of music by ear and then learning the last few bars on each page so it looked as if I knew what I was doing and turning the page over.
I can see that that might have been a bit of a hindrance in forming a career in that direction. I must say, I find it very pleasing that something as beautiful as the Eden Project should have been created by somebody who actually came from music.
Music is a very profound thing, and one of the things it has taught me about life experience is, if you like, symphonic structure, is that actually the experience of gardens or anything, to be really pleasing, needs to... You can't just have greatest hits. You can't just go, wham, look at this, wham, look at that. And one of the things that I adore about both Heligan and Eden is that they're paced. You know, there are pastoral bits, there are very pianissimo bits, and then crescendos, you know. And I think the link to music is actually far deeper, probably, in the way I look at the world than I've ever sort of properly thought about. But I think the other thing that I've noticed at Eden, which is important, is more people write to me about the quality of the binding on the bamboo handrails than anything else. It's as if people love beauty. And I've come to learn over the last few years that beauty isn't a luxury or an accessory. It is something that moves people, and it actually tells you something about the human spirit. And the more I've realised that, the more I realise how damaging it is designing things just for function. Because if things have imported onto them a sense of love and care, it actually inspires all who see it. That sounds very pretentious saying it on a sort of radio interview, but I think beauty is going to be the big thing over the next 5 years. I think we're ready for making it centre stage again.
The gardens, Lost Gardens of Heligan, in particular, have for you a connection with the Beethoven we're about to hear.
Well, some gardens are kind of happy-clappy, and many of the gardens that are regarded as beautiful are actually... they're quite mediocre in the fact that they're kind of like one-trick ponies. Look at this particular bed or wonderful Kiffscape rose or whatever. Heligan is moody. It's got a gentle melancholy, and is at its best when there's a gentle mizzle or drizzle. And Beethoven, and in particular the Moonlight Sonata, for some reason sticks with me as I walk through that garden. It's dark, it's about pools, it's about dusk. And I love that gentle melancholy because it... we often think we need to be amused by things, and actually what we really miss is feeling. People come to Heligan, I mean, it's the best loved garden in Britain, by all accounts. And I think when you talk to people, they go there because it makes them feel something. It isn't just a nice day out. It's something of the soul about it. And I always say it keeps a place in my heart.
Thank you.
The first movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, the Sonata in C-sharp minor, Opus 27, number 2, played by Stephen Kovacevic. What you were saying about that mood music, in a sense, but also that need for feeling, completely bears out our experience on this programme over some 17 years, which is that what people do most love is something which, even if only cathartically, takes them somewhere quite profound, sometimes to tears. And so although people do enjoy music that is light and frothy and even comical sometimes, the overriding desire is for that sensibility that takes one deep inside oneself.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we seem to be embarrassed about that need too. It's as if in certain circles, if people are talking seriously, you're talking seriously again. You know, you're being emotional. Actually, I think if you aren't emotional, you're half dead, aren't you?
I like this combination of music you've put together, Tim Smith, because it plumbs various disciplines. We've got a piece now, which I think probably you heard on a film first.
Yeah, the next two pieces are actually from a film, Diva, by Jean-Jacques Binet. I've very rarely been to see a film, and just been so blown away by it, I went straight back in and watched it a second time. And the weirdest thing about the film was it was like a piece of art. I know a lot of people talk about art house, but every picture was almost a feast to the eye. Very sexy. But again, also dark. Dark and mysterious. I'm rather a fan of dark. And maybe that's a counterpoint to my personality, because I often feel of myself that my shallows have yet to be plumbed. So I kind of get off on almost a sort of surrogate depth through enjoying the emotion of music like this. And the Erik Satie music is just wonderfully mysterious and brave, because I think musicians and composers that create air around the chords that they make, it actually feels like a real statement. It's not like pebbles on a tin roof playing fast for the sake of it or whatever. It's a mastery of mood. It's a beautiful sweep.
Vladimir Kozma wrote this music, and it's a kind of pastiche, isn't it, of
yeah.
Erik Satie's Nocturne?
It is. And I think one of the things about confidence is actually you just play it in such a way that the music not only breathes, but it has, I don't know, it challenges the listener, because it's not asking to be forgiven for anything. It's as if every note was chosen. I wish I had that discipline.
Thank you.
Promenade Sentimentale, composed by Vladimir Kozma for the film Diva of 1982. It's a pastiche, as we said, of Erik Satie's Nocturne, although I think it's more than a pastiche in a way. It brings its own quality, especially some of the harmonic twists.
It does. One of the lovely things about it is obviously using new technology with echo chambers and things at the time, which is completely appropriate to the way the film is, because it looks backwards and forwards. And it's actually, I think, seeking to be timeless, which is actually one of the reasons why I like the second piece, which also comes from the movie, because the word longing or yearning, this piece of music we're about to hear, has got that sense of something just out of reach. Again, very beguiling. I'm very taken with things that feel just out of reach.
Eben ne andro lontano from La Vallée, Act 1 by Catalani. We heard Wilhelmina Fernandez singing there with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Vladimir Kozma. Now, the extraordinary thing for me, Tim Smith, was, because I have a bad hearing problem, is that a rather sort of distorted quality to the music, which also gives it that thing that you rather like, you can't get your fingers on it, as it were, you can't pin it down. But it's rather the way I hear music the whole time, I'm afraid, because of a hearing problem. But it's deliberate, isn't it, in the film?
It is deliberate, because the plot of the film is the lady who's supposed to be one of the world's greatest opera singers who has a fear of being recorded. And the reason it's so flaky is because it's being recorded under the coat of someone who's trying to steal her performance. So that's the whole point of the film. It's good though, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is. And it does have that effect that you were talking about of slightly evading your ears. You just can't pin it down.
Yeah, it does. It does.
You are of partial Dutch origin, aren't you?
Partial Dutch, yes. Yeah.
You've been quite critical in a quite amusing way about our inability to be entrepreneurial in this country, despite the fact you've been a very good entrepreneur in this country.
My tongue is often in my cheek. I think this country is a fabulous country, and I wish it had more confidence in its inventiveness. Many of the things that have shaped our lives have been invented by Brits, and we haven't been that good at, if you like, keeping the jobs for making those things in this country. And I think we have a folk memory of being the world's greatest manufacturing nation. And I think it's a tragedy that we might lose it. And I would like to see us actually really commit to a manufacturing base of making emerging technologies, environmental low carbon technologies and so on. One of the things that has pleased me so much this year was for the whole country to be reminded of what a cool country this is, not only with the Jubilee, but the opening ceremony of the Olympics. I got all teary. I was at it. I got all teary. I thought, what a country to have all of that wealth of stuff, great creative arts, the Industrial Revolution coming out of it, the National Health Service, classical music, the Sex Pistols. It was very brave, I thought, that we showed ourselves off in that particular way. And I felt intensely proud of it. And I got this funny feeling that Britain, sounding a bit jingoistic, which is strange for Dutchmen, Britain might just be on the way back. A lot of people were moved by that, and a lot of people, I think, feel that they can regain their pirate swagger and put invention back on the front foot. But I did have the privilege 2 years ago of being asked to be a judge at the Carbon Trust Awards and actually seeing these young companies doing very cool stuff. I mean, really cool stuff. Actually filled me with optimism again. I just hope that our bankers can, as an act of piety or redemption, can get behind some of these inventions coming through and actually remember what it's like to bank for the future rather than the present.
The Russian steppes in 19th century Russia lies partially behind your choice of the next musician and indeed artist.
Well, Chopin was actually, this is unbelievable, he was a pianist for a while at the stately home that my music business partner, Charlie Skarvek, his family lived in Lvov. And so I've always been rather fond of Chopin just because of that connection. But my love of this piece of music is simply, this sounds ridiculous, but every time I hear it, I think of ladies in gingham dresses and the smell of roses. So it's rather odd. It does conjure up winter and fire and all of that sort of stuff. But the way it affects me is actually quite summery. There you have it.
And the pianist?
Well, Martha Argerich, I was introduced to by my adopted son, who's a very fine pianist himself, and he said, listen to this, and he played me Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto by her, which is just, it's like blousy, and it's as if actually the emotion was the most important thing rather than the accuracy of the playing. And I just loved it. I think we get too precious about accuracy sometimes. So I started to watch quite a lot of her performances on YouTube. I haven't had a chance to see her live yet, but I love that the whole body and soul is going into performance.
And of course, actually, this is known as the heroic Polonaise.
Yes, exactly. How appropriate.
Thank you.
Doesn't it make you want to just drink a glass of vodka and smash it on the wall behind you too?
Absolutely. Marta Argerich playing the Polonaise in A flat, opus 53 by Chopin, the heroic. And certainly, as you say, Tim, with some muscle there.
Yeah.
Now, we mentioned Rachmaninoff, and in the next music, we're going to hear him playing the piano himself in one of the variations from the Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. I heard this just a couple of days ago on the radio, and I just suddenly thought, it's such a brilliantly inventive piece to take a tune and do so much with it.
Well, the reason I chose this is I love Rachmaninoff, just full stop. The man was outrageous, absolutely outrageous, and how dare he have hands that big, you know. But the reason I chose Rachmaninoff is because it was through listening to Rachmaninoff that I first started to get the rumour, if that's the right word, of what genius is. It's very difficult. It's something that you can't touch. But when you see the way he composes, it's true of all great composers I know, but Rachmaninoff somehow, for me, the way he gets complexity to add up, maybe it goes back to that what I was telling you about at the beginning of listening to the chaos of a chord that then becomes a big harmonic chord. It's the way he's constructed and hears how that complexity will lead to something pure and wonderful. I am reminded of the nature of genius because I have no sense of competition with it. I realise it is a gift that is outside of my touch, and I feel very privileged that he has it, that I had the chance to appreciate it. Isn't it delightful?
Absolutely. We heard Sergei Rachmaninoff playing Variation 18 from his own Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, Opus 43, with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Leopold Stokowski. Now, Lerner and Lowe, do you like musicals?
Funnily enough, I like the idea of musicals. I have found many of the modern musicals, had I put this tactfully, have relied on a quality of songwriting that is pretty poor. My Fair Lady is just like, for me, West Side Story as well. They have a genius to them of people who've got an understanding of melody and a sensibility of the words matching the melody, which there's no jarring notes whatsoever, and it's totally plausible. So I like musicals, specific musicals, but if you say, am I a fan of the musicals? No, I am a fan of specific musicals.
But rather with the Vladimir Kosma diva music, we are actually looking at this from a slightly different angle, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, here we're looking at Andrei Previn with the sessions, the Shelley Mann sessions, playing jazz variations on all the popular songs from My Fair Lady. I think Andrei Previn is one of those people who history, I think, will be far kinder to him than the present. And I think because he's got such a talent, but because he handles it so lightly, I think people treat him lightly and don't give him the weight of respect I think he deserves. I mean, his versions of American in Paris, the Gershwin American in Paris, and also Rhapsody in Blue are just great, but they are of a man at the peak of his powers who doesn't need to show off. And we live in a period where if you've got it, you've got to flaunt it. And I think, give it another 20, 30 years, people will come back to a lot of his work and recognise. And also, you're not supposed to be talented in two areas. How dare you be a good jazz pianist as well as a great concert pianist? It's very cool. I mean, in the true sense of the word cool, not it's cool.
Fantastic.
That's amazing, hey. Mm. Don't you agree? We both have our teeth drilled without anaesthetics to be able to play that good, wouldn't we?
Absolutely. I could have danced all night with the dentist or without. From the Shelley Mann album, interpreting My Fair Lady with Andrei Previn at the piano, the original music by Lerner and Lowe. Tim Smit, one of the previous guests on this programme was the theatre director, Michael Grandage. And I think you've been combining with him to develop a theatre
Good Lord. It's a small world, isn't it? Well, Michael's a good Cornish boy. He comes from Penzance. He's a very talented guy. And we're both very interested in the idea of community theatre. Sounds a bit sort of worthy, but using a community to create great theatre, like a sort of kind of Oberammergau type thing where the communities build things and make things. And we have an ambition to build a theatre in the round at Eden to allow for performance both inside and out. It's a very interesting design. So that's going to be one of the things we're going to be hoping to achieve over the next 2 or 3 years. He's got an unbelievably busy schedule. So, I mean, I should have actually wanted to design it with the Pope, but hey.
And geothermal energy is another thing you've been looking at?
Yes, we are based in Cornwall. As those of you know, Cornwall is clay country, which, of course, clay is decaying granite. And we are mounted right on top of the Cornubian basilisk, which is not a phrase you can use when you've had too much to drink. But if you drill down about 4,000 metres, the temperature in the rocks is about 240 degrees centigrade. And we want to build geothermal energy plants down there because we think that we can become completely self-sufficient energy-wise, both for Cornwall, and provide maybe 20% in total, if we drilled all the way down, 20% of the electricity needs of the UK. This goes back to the point I was making about manufacturing, that we're so cowardly in the way we approach stuff. It's as if we're ruled by accountants who don't understand you've got to take brave decisions occasionally to win the big game. And I would love to see us actually achieving all that within the next 3 years.
Let's play you out on something, Tim Smit, which I know you find pretty exciting, not to say sexy. So it's Round Midnight with Thelonious Monk.
I love this piece. I love it. And for those of you who don't like Thelonious Monk, when you heard the Eric Satie earlier on, you hear the melody being suggested to you and then built up. This Monk piece is so cool because it sounds like the clattering of jazz piano, yeah? But you hear this incessant melody coming through and it gets more and more strident. And what it reminds me of, please forgive me for sounding horribly pretentious, but what it really reminds me of are those Rodin sculptures that you see where he's got the raw rock and there's part of the finished sculpture is coming out of it. And this is like a lens on the creative mind. Fantastic it is. You actually hear something that could be the sensational big melody, but it's understated as if the player is just toying around with it, you know, and at any moment it might explode. And that's why it's so damn sexy, let's face it.
Tim Smit, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thelonious Monk with Round Midnight. Sir Tim Smith was talking to Michael Barclay. Next Sunday on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the geneticist Dame Linda Partridge, who specialises in the investigation of age-related diseases. Private Passions is a Classic Arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's just after 1 o'clock. Time now for the news. I'm Jill Anderson. A car bomb explosion outside a police station in the Syrian capital Damascus has killed at least 10 people and injured several more. It happened in a Christian area in the centre of the old city as the United Nations peace envoy Lakhdar Brahimi was meeting President Assad. Mr. Brahimi urged both sides to order immediate ceasefires. In Lebanon, thousands of protesters and mourners have gathered in central Beirut for the funeral of a senior security official killed in a car bomb attack on Friday. The event is also being used to protest against the Syrian government, which opposition politicians say assassinated Wissam al-Hassan. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has confirmed that the government will introduce a new offence of supplying firearms to criminals. Details will be announced by David Cameron tomorrow in a speech outlining what he'll call a tough but intelligent new approach to law and order. Earlier this year, a Home Office assessment of the old offence concluded that any fall in crime would be only temporary. The former head of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Ian Blair, is advising people not to vote in elections to choose police and crime commissioners next month. Sir Ian said the government had gone about introducing commissioners in the wrong way because each would have too large an area to control. The family of a woman killed in a series of hit-and-run incidents in Cardiff on Friday have said she gave her life protecting two of her children. Karina Menzies, who was 32, was one of 14 people injured. A 31-year-old man is being questioned. The former United States Senator and presidential candidate George McGovern has died aged 90. His early and increasingly strong criticisms of the Vietnam War made him a hero of the American left and the anti-war movement. He won the Democratic nomination in 1972, but suffered a landslide defeat to Richard Nixon. And the weather. It'll be a dry afternoon for most of the country, with further sunny spells, the best of which will be in the north and west. Southeastern England will remain rather dull and cloudy, though, with spells of rain, which will spread across much of the south this evening. Well, that's the BBC News and Weather. This is BBC Radio 3, and we're now stepping back in time with the Early Music Show. Here's Catherine Bott. In today's Early Music Show, we're taking a look at a 16th century emperor who had a distinctly musical ear, Charles V. His ear is not the feature of his physiognomy that drew the most attention in his lifetime. No, that was his Habsburg chin. And his love of music isn't what he was known for either. That had to take second place in his life to his role at the head of the Holy Roman Empire. But the fact that the most powerful man in 16th century Europe was musical is immensely helpful to present-day scholars, and of course lovers of early music, because his patronage meant that a great many works associated with him survived to be enjoyed in later centuries. Charles had quite an impressive lineage. He was the son of Philip the Handsome and Joanna the Mad of Castile. His paternal grandparents were Emperor Maximilian and Mary of Burgundy, and his maternal grandparents were Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, the Catholic kings whose marriage had united Spain. And through them, there's an English connection. Their daughter, of course, was Catherine of Aragon, who was the first wife of our own Henry VIII. Charles's cousin was Mary Tudor, who married his son, Philip of Spain. But let's get to the music. Charles himself was born in the Flemish city of Ghent in the year 1500, and his early years were filled with the sound of church music, with daily mass and a constant round of special services to mark all sorts of events. Jacob Obrecht was born in Ghent too, 50 years or so earlier, and most of his appointments were in Flanders, so his sacred music may well have been heard by the young Charles. Here's the first part of his Salve Crux Arbor Vitae. Hail, O cross, illustrious tree of life, banner, throne, and altar of Christ.